Hello, everybody, and welcome to Patriotic Weekly Review, episode number 29. And tonight we will be joined shortly by the incredible Mike Enoch. Now, obviously, you all know who Mike is. I'm sure many of you are here specifically to listen to him. But before he arrives, we're just going to go through a little bit of business. And we are also going to introduce our usual panelists, No White Guilt and Dr. Patrick Slattery. But before we get to them, I just want to say a couple of things. Firstly, if you would like to donate to the show, or if you would like to ask questions, please use Entropy. The link is in the description of the show. It is also in the chat right now. And it is on my Twitter and my Telegram. So please use Entropy. You can ask questions, you can send donations, and the best questions get voted on, and we read all donations out, ask all questions which are attached to a donation, and we ask the top questions each week if we have time from the question panel. So if you want to contribute to the show, please use Entropy. If you would like to contribute financially in other ways, please use Bitcoin. My Bitcoin address is in the show description. And I also mentioned Telegram. We have a Telegram chat group at Patriotic Weekly Review. You can go there after the show and carry on discussing the show with other like-minded people, with viewers of the show, or you can follow me on my Telegram channel. So please go over, do that, make sure you have Telegram. Also, most of you will be watching on YouTube, some people through the Entropy overlay. But you can also now watch us live on RadioAlbion.com, which is run by my good friend Sven Longshanks. He helps me with our IRL events. He's an absolutely fantastic guy. His website's superb. Lots of great content on there. Works tirelessly for this movement. Please go and check that out. And remember, we are now streaming in multiple places, so we're going out to a larger audience every week. Now, one thing which will be addressed shortly, and I'm just opening my calendar, we do this show live every Wednesday, yet we have a situation where both Christmas Day and New Year's Day are Wednesdays. So do people want a New Year's and Christmas show? Obviously, we're not going to do a show on Christmas Day. That would be ridiculous. But we could do one the Monday before, or we could move one to the Friday afterwards to give something to people over the Christmas break. It could be a more relaxed show. It could just be the panelists. It could be a general chat, a bit of a year in review. And we could certainly do one on New Year's Day if you would like us to. We'll keep asking this in the run-up to Christmas. We'll get something sorted, because I don't mind having a week off, but I also don't want to break our streak of 129 weeks in a row, which has been quite some feat. Now, finally, there is a lot of talk at the moment in America about the Groyper movement and people putting very interesting questions to people like Charlie Kirk, to people like Dan Crenshaw. Well, at the moment, you may have heard we're in the middle of a general election campaign here in the UK. Now, that presents us with a very interesting opportunity that people here in the UK could very well go to hustings and put similar and very interesting questions to mainstream candidates at those hustings, film them, and upload it to YouTube. Now, I'm not going to throw people in at the deep end. I'm not going to say to people, right, you must go and do this and go and do it off your own back. But what I am going to say to people is, if you would like to do something like that, if you would like to go to hustings and humiliate your local member of parliament, maybe we could get something together where we formulated some good questions about things like demographics, about the grooming issue, and other issues which are pertinent to our cause. So if people would like to do something like that, let us know in the chat. Let Laura Towler know, and myself and Laura will come together to produce something absolutely fabulous. And after the election, hopefully me and Laura will do an election special. Mike has now joined us, which is very good. And I'd just like to say, Mike, thank you for moving your schedule around. I'm just going to introduce our regular panelists, and then we'll go straight over to you. So, Jason, what have you been up to this week, my friend?
Busy as always for White Wellbeing. Hello, Mike, to you as well.
How's it going?
Good, man. It's going really well. Thanks for asking. Just returned from an IRL, drove through the night to be able to be here in time this morning, got a bunch of work done, and ran into the office just in time. So I'm still pulling up screens, but we have I want to mention, big hello also to everybody in the chat. I saw some great folks that are already here today with us, real heroes. Big hello, of course, to Patrick and our great leader, Mark Collette. But I want to say that later tonight we have a after hours. Jared George and I are going to be on at 9 p.m. Eastern Standard Time. We're going to be with Semiagog, I believe, Oliver. We're going to be talking about some tips for Groypers. I haven't been as privy to as many of these videos as maybe perhaps some of the others. I've been very busy, but I've heard from some others that there have been some little bit of going off of the rails, exactly what I predicted would happen unless people were admonished to stay on track. So we'll see. We'll talk about that tonight. And then tomorrow there is a tap, and who is on tap? None other than Angelo John Gage, or John Angelo Gage, or whichever he goes by. We will properly call him the name he wants to use. But he'll be on with us tomorrow on tap in the evening time. Not exactly. We haven't ironed out the hour exactly, but probably 4, 5, 6, 7 range Eastern Standard Time. But other than that, it's been a busy week, and happy to be here with you all as always.
Okay, thank you, Jason. I just realized I was muted there. I've muted you, Mike, for a second because we're just getting a bit of sound off you. Is Patrick in the house? Now, Patrick said he was going to be a couple of minutes late. He has something very important to tell us about when he arrives as well. So if he arrives late, He's here.
I'm here. Indeed. Well, this is always where we talk about what we've been up to the past week. And My life is so humdrum, and it's the same thing over and over again. I always say, well, I did my radio show on RBN with Mark Collette every Monday. And, you know, I help out David Duke with his shenanigans. And then I'm the co-host on Stormfront Radio with Don Black. I've been his co-host for the past few years. And the thing is, of course, it's, you know, no secret, he's got bad health, and every now and then goes through these episodes that can last weeks or even months. And suddenly the show's all mine. And, you know, one thing is, given my background, I'm not the first person that you would think of for a host for the Stormfront radio show. So it's, you know, but we, between the audience and myself, we've adjusted pretty well to each other. You know, I'm an old peacenik Naderite type, and so not exactly the first person that you would expect. But anyway, so at the beginning of this month, or maybe late last month, Don had another bout that took him off of the show, and I was doing it, and, you know, I wasn't sure how long this was going to last. And I thought, okay, well, I'm going to rename the show. I'm just going to rename the show, change the show. And so I started calling it from Stormfront Radio. I renamed it to the Morning Aloha Report. And I changed the theme song to Aloha Way. And it got a little bit of feedback. Now, the Stormfront audience, I think they knew what I was doing. And but some of the people, there was some people in Hawaii, there were some people in the liberal press who kind of had a freak out. And I usually don't talk too much at this part of the show, but if you'll indulge me, I just want to read a little bit. This is from the Daily Cause, which I guess KOS, it's a Democratic leaning blog that's, you know, fairly large. A radio program promoted by longtime Ku Klux Klan leader David Duke has rebranded itself the Morning Aloha Report and credited Tulsi Gabbard for the inspiration. I endorsed Tulsi Gabbard back in April, and then Joe Rogan immediately copied off of me. But I wasn't trying to turn this into like the Tulsi show. But at any rate, formerly called Stormfront Radio, listeners to the white nationalist show were informed of the name change on Thursday by program host Patrick Slattery. It goes on, listeners, woke up to find their popular call-in radio show had been rebranded the Morning Aloha Report. Instead of starting with the show with refrains of the old Confederate standard, "The South Will Rise Again," a heartfelt 1917 rendition of Aloha Away introduced the show. Co-host Dr. Patrick Slattery informed the audience that he changed his name to Patrick Aloha and welcomed callers with Aloha instead of the Shalom, y'all, greeting that he was previously known for. Dr. Aloha said that whites embodied the Aloha spirit when they ended slavery, a scourge to humanity that had persisted since time immemorial across the globe. He noted that whites had brought modern medicine and public health to the far corners of the earth, reducing infant mortality and doubling life expectancy. They're quoting me, right? Their technology and culture have greatly enriched the lives of people everywhere. While this process wasn't always smooth or without ulterior motives, in general, whites have shown tremendous altruism and thus truly embodied the Aloha spirit. He declared that henceforth, white people will be known as Aloha Americans. You know, it goes on and on. And there wasn't a whole lot of pushback from our audience. There was one guy who called up and said, "You know, Slattery, that new song sounds kind of gay." But otherwise, I people knew what I was doing. I looked through some blogs and some local Honolulu sites, and one of the local Honolulu news sites said they had contacted Tulsi Gabbard's office for a reaction, and they didn't get a response. But this is the thing. We're not that bad, and white people aren't that bad. And yet, just the mere fact that we would advocate for white interests, like everybody, all the other groups advocate for their own interests, the mere fact that we would advocate for our own interests makes us persona non grata at polite company anywhere. And, I don't think there's anything factually wrong about what I was saying. And the weird thing is, a lot of the people who were pushing back at the cultural appropriation of the Aloha spirit were some of them were mainlanders who had moved to Hawaii themselves. Maybe some were, third generation Asians whose ancestors had moved to Hawaii. But I don't see why, I've been to Hawaii. I know something about Hawaii. I don't see why they have any more right to define the Aloha spirit than I do. I mean, I don't think I have any more right to define, say, the Cherokee spirit just because I, maybe live in North Carolina than somebody from Hawaii would. I'm not a Cherokee. So I don't know. The whole thing was kind of ridiculous. I wasn't trying to cause trouble for Tulsi Gabbard, and I really didn't spend a whole lot of time talking about her, although in the press release that I released through David Duke's Twitter site, I did use as a featured image a very, very attractive photo of her in a wetsuit standing with a surfboard. But otherwise, I really didn't try to drag her in that much. But, that's the whole thing. So she has to be contacted to renounce me or to renounce David Duke or to renounce people. I don't remember anybody, even people who had been, say, very much against the these Zionist wars or regime change wars. I don't remember anybody contacting Hillary and saying, Republicans, Max Boot, right? These neocon Republicans like Max Boot or Robert Kagan, who officially endorsed Hillary. Nobody asked her to denounce or renounce these people who had brought us these horrible wars and other things. So, without belaboring it too much, it's just, why are we so horrible that we have to be renounced? Nobody can have any association with us. Why is it that, Donald Trump gets elected president with significant help from us, and he can't talk to us. He can't talk to us. He can't even say that the people at Charlottesville, well, there were good people and bad people on both sides, which is, you know, a truism anytime you're talking about thousands of people. He can't even say that without, you know, calls of, for impeachment. So I guess I'll leave it at that. But if you all want to talk about it more, you know, we can.
Well, thank you, Patrick. And now we are going to introduce our special guest, the one and only Mike Enoch. Now, he hasn't been on this show yet. He has been on our previous show, but this is his first time on Patriotic Weekly Review. And it is always the greatest honor to have Mike on the show. Mike has repeatedly brought in the largest numbers the show has had. The only person who came close to you, actually, or I think she actually equaled you, was Syrian Girl. Syrian Girl's first appearance brought in a lot of watches. But you and Syrian Girl, you hold the sort of joint title for most popular guest on the show. And you've obviously been on more times than she has. You always bring an amazing crowd. You do amazing work. I love coming on your show. And a lot has been going on recently, especially in America, especially with what's been going on with the Turning Point USA movement. I'm sure people want to talk a bit about that tonight. But what have you been up to, Mike? Introduce yourself. Say a bit about yourself, where we can find your excellent work. And, you know, open up the show with anything you want to discuss.
I think people know I host TDS and Strike and Mike on the rightstuff.biz. We have we do TDS Monday, Wednesdays, and Fridays. Strike and Mike comes out Tuesdays, and then Thursdays we have alternating call-in shows. One Thursday it's my co-host Sven and Jazz Hands. Next Thursday it's me and Johnny Monoxide. So tomorrow night we're gonna have me and Johnny on. It's Mike and the Mad Wop. You know, we just actually got done recording our show here. I'm in the TRS studio down here. It's a fun place to be. And so, yeah, I don't know. I don't really have much else to introduce me than that. If you want me to sort of kick off a topic, I was listening to what Patrick was saying, and it occurred to me this idea of the Aloha spirit and, you know, who gets to define that or whatever. And the fact is that the Aloha spirit, as defined by whoever it was that was pushing back on Patrick's use of that term, all they talk about, it's not anything different than liberalism, right? It's not anything different. Like, the Aloha spirit is just like the same corporate liberal crap. Like, that's what everybody says when they say this. I remember a couple of years ago, you know, Richard Spencer was at, this is just an example, he was at Texas A&M University. And they're like, you don't represent, your ideas don't represent the Aggie spirit. Well, what's the, that's what students at that college call themselves, Aggies. What's the Aggie spirit? Same as the Aloha spirit. It's just corporate liberalism. It's just Google Human Resources Department liberalism, right? That's what all of this stuff is. And if you ask anybody to define, there's nothing special. I mean, the Aloha spirit, it could be something special if it was something unique to the Hawaiian people, but it's not. They're taking it and saying, oh, no, this just means be nice to everyone and no hate and blah, 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 and buy stuff at the store and go on Google.com and whatever, right? That's what all that stuff means. So, I don't know, that just occurred to me as you were talking about the Aloha spirit. I was like, it would be nice if the Hawaiian people had something that was unique to them, that was their own spirit. I don't think they do anymore. It's been taken from them. So just like it's been taken from us. That's all.
So one thing I do want to ask you, we've got a general election here happening at the moment. Okay. Do you have any hot takes on that? Or do you think that we should do similar here in the UK as what's going on with the Turning Point USA movement in the US? Do you see that as a positive thing? Do you think we should try the same with our politicians?
I definitely think you should, but I have a lot of praise for what those guys are doing, but I have a couple of criticisms. I think there's a few ways that they could, and of course,
whoa there, guys, Mike. I got into this. If you're going to get into this mire, prepare for some blowback. I gave the fine. Most mild criticisms of these guys on Ethan Ralph's show, and they went crazy.
That's fine. Look, I'm not even saying they've done anything wrong. I'm just saying I think there's a smart. I've tried to present what I think is a really smart way to ask some of these questions. That's all I'm doing. I'm not like looking to say you're doing it all wrong. A lot of these guys are like what 19, 20 years old. And, you know, this is their first foray into politics. I don't have any criticisms of that. I think that just some of the ways the questions are centered, I think, is a mistake and leaves an opening that that some of these conservative figures can exploit. But I think generally speaking, it's good to go out and attack the conservative establishment. And I believe the purpose of attacking the conservative establishment should be to discredit the conservative establishment, to make whites understand these people are not here for you. These people, in fact, don't want you. In fact, they will throw you under the bus to their own detriment, seemingly to their own detriment, if you don't understand who's really controlling them and what forces are really behind them. So, you know, one of the things I always say is a lot of people go up and they say things like, well, Mr. Kirk or Mr., you know, Zyoclops, as they call him, Zyclops, Dan Crenshaw, the one-eyed Zionist. You know, if you don't do something about the demographic situation, the Republican Party isn't going to be able to win elections. And then where what happens to our wonderful American values then? My thing is like, hey, the GOP's values are not my values, first of all. Second of all, I don't consider the white race to be a vehicle for the GOP. And it seems like when you ask the question that way, that's how you're presenting it. You're saying, hey, look, we white people, we're here for you. And you're not using us. I mean, no. You're supposed to be here for us. And if you're not here for us, then you don't need to be here anymore. That's my position. So I think that's kind of the and if you go to these people, instead of saying like, here's what your interests are and here's why you should believe that that I am going to serve your interests, you should say, no, you're a politician. What are you doing for me? We're white. We don't want any more immigration. We don't want any more. We would like to have the middle of our country have manufacturing jobs brought back. We're tired of outsourcing and free market capitalism, moving jobs overseas, getting rid of good middle class and working class jobs for people so they can form communities. We're sick of immigration, lowering wages. We're sick of immigration, destroying our communities. We're sick of attacks in the media. All of these things. What are you going to do for us, Mr. Charlie Kirk? Rather than say, here, Kirk, Charlie, please, what can we do for you? Please listen, please. If you don't, if we get in more immigration, then you won't win anymore. I just don't think that's the right way to focus the question. That's my opinion.
Yeah, I, by the way, I was joking when I was like, whoa, don't criticize them. I wasn't meaning you can't. Obviously, I was only joking. They take criticism badly.
the amount of crap I have gotten. I mean, when you put yourself out there on the internet as a personality talking about stuff, you're going to get huge amounts of crap thrown at you. I've just become immune to it at this point.
Well, look, I'm so bold, I'm going to repeat my criticism of the situation. Mm. And it is only very mild criticism. I see this as a real positive, what they're going out and doing. But it's kind of like the GOP and Turning Point USA. Let's have a little bit of an analogy. It's like a boat, and it's heading in the wrong direction.
Mm-hmm.
And these guys are on board the boat. So you've either got to do one of two things if you don't like where the boat's going. Firstly, you take over the boat and you turn it round and you head it in a better direction. Or secondly, you set fire to the boat and you burn it with all the rotten crew on board. But if you're going to do that, you need to build another boat that's temporarily at the side of the boat that's on fire so that you and all of the good people on it who want an alternative can jump on board something better, which then sets off in the better direction that we talked of earlier. And my only mild criticism was that they need a game plan. It can't just be enough to go and humiliate mainstream conservatives.
Right.
All the people who are woken up through these actions need to be offered an alternative. And if they're not offered an alternative, there needs to be a plan to capture the mainstream conservative apparatus in order to control it. Because this isn't all for sort of memeing in real life. This is for the survival of our people. It's
right.
Not so that we all have a good laugh and a giggle and then post our best moments to Twitter whilst hiding behind Pepe memes. It's to save our people. There has to be a plan. There has to be a route to power. There has to be a way to turn things around and get people somewhere better. Mm-hmm. And my only very mild criticism, which I got quite a bit of blowback for, was just that there needs to be, you know, somebody in the chat just said, yes, Mark, we need a lifeboat before we sink the ship. And there does need to be that. And I implore the people who are part of this so-called America First movement to set up a proper organization so that all these people now who want to jump off the burning ship can jump into something better. I mean, what do you think? What's your take on that, guys?
Well, I think you're right, but I think there are some organizations out there. I believe that there is, like, I think the American Identity Movement is heavily involved in this and things like that. But I think that I understand what you're saying, but I also think it's very organizing in the United States, particularly since Charlottesville, has been difficult. There's a lot of barriers to it. People are very afraid for their identities. There's a lot of barriers to it. I think we can go over what they are. We all kind of know what they are. That doesn't mean we should stop attacking the GOP, because I think what we want to get people in the frame of mind of is white people have valid interests, and people going up there. And I think my criticism would be somewhat different than yours. I think they're not putting white interests forcefully enough at the center of their questioning. Yes. I think that's most important. A vehicle, a party, things like that can come, but I think we also have to change the consciousness of the people. And so, I'm sort of repeating what I said before. They're putting sort of the Republican Party's interests at the center of their questioning. Yeah. When that's not, I do not believe the Republican Party is a good vehicle for us anymore. I did at one point think that, but I've changed my mind. I think that after butting heads with it for years, I've come to the conclusion they are. What they are controlled by these plutocrats and these very wealthy people of various ethnic backgrounds that have their own interests that are diametrically opposed to those of white America, in fact, and white people in Europe as well. So I think that what I would have wanted to do, and whenever I would watch some of these streams, I would see some of these young guys, and all my hats off to them. I mean, it takes a lot of courage to go and put your face out there and go directly challenge some of these people, and some of them did great. Some of them did really great. But I just think that the attitude needs to be white. You need to appeal to us. Mm-hmm. And if you can't do it, you have to be exposed as being unable to do it. So a friend of mine had said, you know, we were talking a bit back and forth. What would be a good question? A friend of mine on Twitter just said, I've recently been kicked off again for the 10th time. He said, you know, if I were there, I would just go up and say, can you say something nice about white people? Can you just say something nice and just see what they do with that? Because they won't be able to do it. No. They will not be able to do it. So, yeah.
I've just got another thing to say as well. Before we go around the group with this, this is my other thought. And I always think this is a very risky strategy, because rather than laying out, well, this is how it seems to me, and if I'm really wrong about this, I would like people to say, look, Mark, you're wrong. You've got this all wrong. But it seems that both sides of this debate, the sort of Charlie Kirk side and the Groyper side, are all appealing to authority. And that authority is Donald Trump. Yes. So Charlie Kirk saying, look, I'm here with Donald Trump Jr. I represent Trump. I'm representing Trump. I'm the voice of Trump on campuses. And that's what Charlie Kirk's saying. And then all the Groypers are saying, we're humiliating you, mate, because you're not really America First. And we're the ones who really embody what Donald Trump is saying. And I think that's kind of a risky strategy, because you're appealing to this authority who may well, in the next couple of months, as he moves into sort of re-election mode, disavow you. He may well turn round and say, you know what? My dog in the fight is Charlie Kirk. And these guys coming out to embarrass him, they're not friends of mine. They're not friends of my view of America First. They're not, you know, MAGA boys. They're people trying to disrupt my re-election campaign. And if you don't support my son, because I mean, it is his son, he's going to come down on his son's side. You know, if you don't, you know, support my son's, I don't know if it's his wife or girlfriend, the gobby woman.
Yeah,
that.
Well, I mean, he's already done that. Trump has taken sides. Trump is with Kirk.
That's what I'm saying. So it's very bad. I personally think if you're appealing to an authority who can actually give, you know, it's one thing appealing to an authority that's either like dead or a deity that can't answer. And you can say, well, he's definitely on my side because I've interpreted the scriptures and had a message. You know, but if you're appealing to an authority that can actually give an authoritative stamp and say he is on your side or not on your side, that's a very risky game. And I can already see a lot of disavowals coming out. I can already see people trying to spin round on their previous positions, wishing they hadn't said things. And I can see the whole thing in the end being actually derailed by Trump. I mean, you know, let's go around the whole panel. We'll start with you, Mike. What do you think? That am I off the mark, or do you see it in a similar manner?
Yeah, I mean, I would say that it would be a mistake to present that way to begin with, because Trump, I don't even think it's a question. Trump has, we know what side he's on. His son is going out there now. His son didn't write that dumb book that they were doing at their book signing. Whatever. I'm sure that he had some ghostwriter and he's put his name on it. But, you know, they booed them off stage. I like that. That's what I want to see. I like the fact that Donald Trump Jr. also was humiliated. That was good. He needs to be humiliated too. He and Charlie Kirk both need to be humiliated. I don't think people should be centering Donald Trump because, again, as you said, I don't think it's a question that he might. He has. We know where Donald Trump stands. He stands with his son-in-law, Jared Kushner. That's where Trump stands. He stands with Benjamin Netanyahu. That's where Trump stands. Okay, we know this. And all of his actions, and yes, Trump has said a lot of things. He's talked a great game. I was a big supporter, huge supporter. 2016, he talked a great game. He talked a great game in 2017. And even someone into 2018. He doesn't talk such a great game anymore. Mm-hmm. And I'll tell you what, coming up on the election, he's going to start talking a good game again. But he's not going to give us anything. And even if he would, it would still be our interests are at the center, and he is just a vehicle for us. That's how it always had to be. We can't, and it's very tempting. And this is what Patrick was talking about before, how it's a third rail in America to talk about white interests. We can go into why we've all, I'm sure, done hours and hours on that on our various shows. But because of that, people have this feeling like, I want to sneak that by something. I want to say, oh, no, it's Trump. It's not really Trump. Okay, even for a lot of these people, it's not that you're all about Trump. If you're just all about Trump, then just get on board with whatever he's going to say. You want something bigger. You want a revival and a protection of white America. That's what you really want. That's what America First, in my understanding, which started as the original America First movie was like Charles Lindbergh and people wanted to stay out of World War II.
Right.
For very, very good reasons. And so, you know, that's what that originally meant. It's like, we don't want to take part. We don't want to help the Soviet Union defeat Germany. Why would we? We have no interest in that. In fact, arguably, you know, maybe take a different side. But be that as it may, though, the point is that we have to have the confidence to go out there and say that we are the ones that you need to appeal to. We are at the center of this. Our interests come first to us. So we can't be hiding behind, oh, no, we're just the Trump movement. No, we're just this, we're just that. We're the GOP, and without whites, the GOP doesn't win. Without whites, Trump doesn't win. I mean, those things are true. But if Trump just used us, which it appears he did, then I'm not going to put his interests first. It's like, oh, sorry, Donald Trump, the white race is a vehicle for you. No, it's got to be the other way around.
So, Patrick and Jason, what do you guys think on this one?
It looks like Patrick's already unmuted, so please, sir, go right ahead, and I'll jump in next.
Okay. I just to finish up on the whole Aloha thing, yeah, Mike's, like he says, you know, it's corporate, just, you know, PR. It really doesn't mean a whole lot. It hasn't meant a whole lot since statehood, right? Frankly, yeah. I mean, been co-opted mostly by the tourist industry. But the thing is, you know, there are so few Hawaiians left. To the extent they are left, they are mixed. There are very few pure Hawaiians left. They're so marginalized. And that was kind of the point of taking, you know, that slogan, that greeting from the completely marginalized group. But anyway, moving on to the Groypers, I see a lot positive there and a lot that's hopeful. You know, there are obviously there are shortcomings, but I tend to expect shortcomings. And when I see less shortcomings than expected, then I'm it's positive. The in terms of you know, referring to authority, yes, sure, Charlie Kirk, he has the Trump presidency on his side. The Groypers have the Trump candidacy on their side. And, you know, the candidate Trump and President Trump, as we know, have turned out to be two very different entities. You know, whether the Groypers would be able to show the sophistication to make that distinction clear and understandable to people, we'll see. Maybe they will. They're showing a fair amount of sophistication as it is. I mean, I'm impressed because, you know, the American electorate in general isn't very sophisticated. They are, I mean, they've been very easily manipulated by, you know, a few hot button issues for decades. Abortion, just abortion, woman's right to choose or life or whatever. It just they've been led one way or another by the nose just based on a few little slogans. Mm-hmm. What's interesting about the Groypers' questioning of Charlie Kirk and his associates is, you know, so many of the questions are about demographics and about immigration. And Charlie Kirk, he can fall back and say, look, I oppose birthright citizenship. I oppose the diversity lottery. I oppose chain migration.
Does he say that?
He says that. And that would be great. If we got those policies, that would be great. He says it every time he's asked. But that's the thing, is he only says it when he's asked. And this is the level of sophistication. The Groypers see through this. Because if he was putting his energy into that, if he was going on a book tour, and the book, you know, I don't know what the name of his book is, but if the book was Stop the Chain, you know, Break the Chain or something like that, if the purpose of his tour was to end chain migration and birthright citizenship and the diversity.
Then he wouldn't get a tour.
We'd be all for it. Well, hey, they wouldn't let him have a tour, right?
Yeah, he would be fired.
We'd be all for it. The thing is, what's important isn't so much where you, you know, check off a whole laundry list of issue and positions. That's not what's important. The important thing is, what's your emphasis? What are the priorities? What are you directing your energy at? And what he's directing his energy at is going around and, you know, he'll invite up a Mexican lady on stage. You know, she immigrated, but she embraces our values, the values that define us as a people. She is a real American. Oh. And then, you know, the business about being opposed to birthright citizenship, that's just kind of a throwaway line he uses as a smokescreen. And the Groypers are seeing through it. And that's why I say there's a lot of sophistication because, you know, I do a lot of call-in shows. And, you know, I mentioned Tulsi Gabbard earlier, and I like what she's saying about foreign policy. And more than that, I like the fact that that's pretty much all she talks about. You know, sometimes she talks about First Amendment, but mostly it's all the foreign policy stuff. And somebody will call up and say, oh, she's a gun grabber. And maybe she said some gun control things in the past. I mean, she said some pro-Second Amendment things in the past. I don't exactly know where she stands on it precisely because it's not the emphasis. And, you know, right now we're not even – it's not even like voting for her for president. We're just trying to keep her in the debate because she says a lot of things that are important to be said. And so, I you know, I'm very pleased that the Groypers are seeing through Charlie Kirk – that, you know, he has these positions, which if they were enacted into law would be great. But Charlie Kirk isn't really doing anything to push them.
Yeah, but there's a lot of positions he has that if they were enacted into law would be disastrous, too.
Well, I would say
like 75%, if not more.
Well, you know, but it's not even an issue of what percentage of his positions are bad. But the point is that he's steering people in a bad direction. He's steering people. Even though he says he's for ending birthright citizenship, he's not steering the discussion in a way that's going to end birthright citizenship. He's steering it in a way that birthright citizenship no longer becomes an issue. It's like, oh, why are we even talking about it? I'm for it. We're all in agreement. And then he brings on the Mexican lady and says she's the embodiment of American values.
Right.
And if
I mean, he's just a shill. I mean, he's just paid corporate shill. Like he just does whatever they pay him. He just says he doesn't have any positions. If we could raise $1 million, we could get him to dance like a monkey for us. It's not, you know, like he's just. It's like I don't even analyzing him. It's like what power structure is he the face of?
Yeah,
and that's what's important. And what are they? And they're never gonna. They don't want to end immigration. They love it. It's a big business lobby is behind them.
And if you look at the, you know, what you refer to as the kosher sandwich, and, you know, I call like the two sides of the Jewish agenda. I mean, one part of the Jewish agenda has been in past decades, it's been dished out to the Democratic Party. That's what people call the cultural Marxism. That's the recently, especially the immigration, although it was not quite as partisan back in the 80s or 70s, but the immigration, the trannyism, the gay marriage, all that gets the social.
Well, now Charlie Kirk does that, right?
Now
that's his agenda. Now he pushes all the homosexual stuff. The Democrats don't even have to anymore.
So
cultural Marxist is Charlie Kirk,
right? Sorry. And then the other side of the kosher sandwich, as you call it, was dished out to the Republicans. That was the Zionist wars. That's the wars for Israel, the wars in the Middle East, Cold War confrontation with Russia. Well, now the Democrats are just as much in favor of that as the Republicans are starting to come along on the gay stuff. But the thing is,
look, the Republicans never met a Zionist agenda that they weren't happy to take the burden of. Like, please let us take this upon our shoulders, Zionists. We will push this agenda for you. That is why we exist.
So the thing is, you had a situation where you had debates on social matters, which the Democrats were taking the Jewish side, and the Jewish side was going to win, and the Republicans just put up like some sort of nominal opposition. And then on the foreign policy side, you had this Zionist agenda, which was wars in the Middle East in particular, but also regime changes around the world, and the Democrats might put up some sort of nominal opposition, but they were it was written into the script. In effect, that they were going to lose, and so you had the Zionist side winning on both sides, and the only time that Jews are like on literally on both sides, different sides of an issue, is when some don't want to go quite so fast. It's a little bit like slow it down, don't rock the boat. We've got things good. So sometimes you'll have your Steve Miller who might want to slow down immigration because it's rocking the boat, that type of thing.
Well, I actually have a different narrative on Stephen Miller, but that's okay.
You might know more about Steve Miller in particular, but I'm just
saying. I have a theory on him, but yeah.
Steve Miller. Yeah, I think, I don't know, Patrick, if I'm getting you right on this, I think you're sort of somewhat off the point. I mean, Charlie Kirk pretty much, he did absolutely explicitly say that he does not believe demographics are destiny, that he believes America is an idea, that America is a group. People who had an idea.
Yeah, it's an idea.
Who has that idea? Anyone who has that idea in states they hold that idea can become American.
Right.
And it makes absolutely no difference where in the world you come from.
Exactly.
If you say,
that's his whole point. That's the thrust of all his energy. He can then when he's asked about things, he said, "Well, look, I'm for ending birthright citizenship. I'm for ending the diversity lottery. I'm for ending chain migration." Those are just throwaway lines for him. And so what I'm saying is these groupers, these young Zoomers, are very sophisticated to see past it and concentrate on where his energy is really going and not be beaten back by those throwaway lines, which might be his positions, but they're his positions because they're losing positions. They're not going to go into effect. So there's no downside to him saying he's for ending birthright citizenship because it's not going to happen. You see what I mean?
No, because there's lots of things that you could say are not going to happen. So it's all right. People say it, I could say, I could make pledges that are not going to happen. I don't understand.
You shouldn't get credit for talking about something that's not going to happen that you're not even pushing for. I'm not giving Charlie Kirk any credit.
What I'm saying here is that Charlie Kirk's that guy. If I'm incorrect, pull me up on this one. But he's the guy that when Trump pressured Botswana to legalize homosexuality, he was the one who did the tweet that was like, "Boom! This is the biggest victory in the history of American politics."
That's really about.
What? The biggest victory of the whole Trump establishment is he's spreading the LGBT menace to other parts of the world.
I think that though, rather than simply understand what you're talking about, which is that Charlie Kirk, there are certain positions that he will say he takes so he doesn't have to deal with questions. Like, sure, I'm against, like, illegal immigration. Oh, I'm very much against it, right? But as you said, there's no substance behind it.
There's no substance.
I think just rather than understanding that, because anybody can see that. Everyone can see that. It's a very easy thing to see. We need to analyze, why is this what he's saying? And what is going on? What are the dynamics that are producing this outcome where you have this guy who he goes up there to push what he wants on the crowd, which is what his bosses really want, which is the people funding his organization, which, by the way, if you go to national-justice.com, Eric Stryker has an excellent article on who funds Kirk. And you can see who all the plutocrats are and what their interests are. I think none of us here will probably be too surprised who it is. You can probably guess, not maybe the individuals, but possibly some of their affiliations, maybe certain congregations they might belong to. So, you know, those are throwaway lines. He just wants to get past that. But the thing is, why is it everyone in the crowd cares so deeply about that? Because that's what their issue is. That's what's affecting them. Kirk is there to say, no, we need free markets. We need homosexuality. And that's what Trump is about. Trump's about free markets and homosexuality. You know, there's the immigration thing. Sure, we're against that. Let's next question, please. And so, you know, just seeing through him, I mean, it's very easy. I'd have to push back. You know, that just takes sophistication. That's just simple. I've seen through Charlie Kirk. The first minute I saw him, I thought, oh, this guy looks like fake. You know, I wonder if this guy's fake. Gee, you know, is water wet? You know, is the sun rising in the east? You know, it's like, yeah, obviously he's a fake. So the question is, who does he represent? But what is the power structure he's out here?
You know who he represents. But in the past, you've had people, Charlie Kirk type people, you know, they haven't been seen through. And that's why you have the Simpson-Mazzoli Act. That's why you had the 1965 Immigration Act. If there had been the same level of sophistication, which probably meant same level of information, which
the public was very much against the 1965 Immigration
Act. They weren't. No,
that was pushed through with that was very unpopular.
85% of Republican Congress people voted for it.
Yeah, but was the public ever asked?
No.
Well, it was debate. I mean, I'm not.
Do you think that if we had a popular vote on that?
No. But you don't have popular vote on anything.
I understand that. So you can't say it was popular.
No, I'm not saying
it was political. These people were paid money by Jacob Javits and a number of other Jewish plutocrats to take these positions. Right. I mean, this is a bribeocracy. It wasn't popular. That's what people have to understand.
It wasn't popular.
The positions that public figures take are almost irrelevant.
Right. Well, it wasn't ever popular, but the thing is they've been getting away with it, in spite of it not being popular. And what I think that maybe I shouldn't be, but I'm impressed with the young kids who are seeing through and calling out the nonsense that people in the the Gang of 4 days of Gang of 8 days of a decade. Yeah, or the people in the late 80s in Simpson-Mazzoli or 1965, you weren't getting that type of popular pushback. And now
the smartness of them is figuring out a strategy. It's not that they saw it through. Everyone's known these people are full of crap for a long time. Is they came up with a strategy to trap them. That was what was clever. They found a way that they could embarrass them publicly and trap them and use their own BS against them, use these... We're out here doing the campus culture clash. It's like, okay, so why are you up here promoting, you know, homosexuality and immigration? Because it's like literally we requested the opposite of this. Mm-hmm. And that's what I would say.
That's it's a great strategy. But just one last point. In 1965, there was a Senator Eugene McCarthy, who's best known for running against Johnson in the 1968 primaries and effectively pushing him out of the White House. And he was in the Senate in 1965. And he was a co-sponsor of the the Hart-Celler bill. Mm-hmm. And about 15 years later, he did a mea culpa. And in 1992, shortly before he died, he published a book called America, a Colony of the World. And there was a chapter on it. Mm-hmm. And, you know, he was an intelligent person. He was a very intelligent person. And yet he was explaining how it was that he, as an intelligent person with a lot of information, believed the the arguments that were being presented by, you know, people from the various.
I don't believe that.
Yeah. Well, because the thing is, the original bill, the original bill was rejected largely by Southern Democrats who were worried about demographics. The Southern Democrats were really the only people who had been opposed to it, and they were worried about the demographics. And so it was because the original bill, took out all the racial quotas or national origins quotas. And so they reworked it and they put in the family reunification. And in the context of 1965, who would have family that would be eligible? Who would have, say, uncle or first cousin? Maybe some Italians. Some
Jews, and they pushed it because they hated the immigration quota. They were saying, the United States having an immigration quota prevented us from being able to come here from Germany. And then we want to be able to bring people over, whatever. But it was also, there's other reasons why they pushed that. But as far as Gene McCarthy, he was like an anti-war guy, and that was where his primary popularity came from.
Yeah, in 1968.
He used that popularity, genuine popularity, to help promote something unpopular. Yeah.
The 65 was 3 years before his big popularity came.
Okay, you're right. I'm sorry.
But I take him seriously that he didn't understand what was going to happen, because in 1965, who had relatives? There were, some people, maybe some war brides from Germany, some Italians. There weren't a lot of people who would have had relatives that would have qualified. But what happened after that? You started getting refugee crises. And so you all of a sudden, you get
Vietnam. Well, I guess I could see it in terms of like, okay, I didn't quite get what that meant when they put that in there, that they were going to start bringing people over, right? And then chaining their whole family. I can understand if you didn't see that coming, sure.
Those were the seeds of chain migration. And then the wars in Central America, you get the Central Americans coming in,
right?
Of migration. You get the amnesty. Now the Mexicans who might have come over. And then the diversity lottery. Well, we don't have any seeds of immigration from Bangladesh or from Somalia or from Zaire or from Nigeria. So plant more, just scatter seeds of chain migration. And they didn't see it coming.
I'm skeptical, but. Who knows? It doesn't really matter. I mean, we know what happened now.
It happened. And some people, but I, the thing
I
is,
I mean, Gene McCarthy's personal psychology is almost less interesting than Charlie Kirk's. I mean, I don't know. It's just like, I find the analyzing the personalities of these people to be uninteresting. Charlie Kirk is like a boring, he's like a really boring guy. Like, I don't know how they picked this guy. He's just like, seems like a nervous, kind of weird, boring guy, and he's up there because he's willing to say all this crap. And I actually knew somebody who knew him from college in a campus libertarian group and said he was a total just a nothing, like he's an empty suit. And that's why he's the guy that's the head of the sort of thing. He'll say whatever. And this is an organization that is funded by very wealthy, most of them are Jewish, some of them are goys, but they are very wealthy in the shipping industry, one of them, and a few other industries that are heavily focused on immigration. So these are Jewish people and plutocratic capitalists that fund him. So we know what he's going to do. I think that's what we need to be talking about. What is the power structure? What are their interests? Not like, what does Charlie Kirk personally believe? I don't care.
It's not about Charlie Kirk personally or about Eugene McCarthy personally, but there is. Out of 535 members of Congress, 400 or so had voted for that.
And how many of them took, what was their campaign finance looking like that year,
Well, the thing is, if you look at campaign, you didn't have the transparency in campaign finance laws until after Watergate. But after Watergate, initially you had a huge... it was, revealed the big Jewish contribution to the Democrats. The Jews didn't contribute as much to the Republicans. But, so some of it comes from finance. Some of it comes from, effective bribery. But then if it was all just people being bought off, they wouldn't bother constructing these narratives. And they need the narratives, partly for the public, but also partly because a lot of these Congress people really aren't that smart. They're just regular people. Mm-hmm. And so So, you know, we're deconstructing like what you're talking about, where's the money coming from, but also like what you do on your show all the time, you're also deconstructing the narratives. And
yes. You
know,
that's what we have to do. Well, we have to deconstruct the narratives too, because that's what they give to the people. And Charlie Kirk, I think what we're seeing with him is a narrative at the end of its rope, where it belongs, frankly, which is, and that narrative is this, bogus melting pot. As long as you have the idea, as long as you love liberty and free markets and freedom of religion. I mean, who loves freedom of religion and freedom of speech? I mean, I like freedom of speech, but that's because I want to say what I want to say. People don't love freedom of religion. They love their religion, you know, and they want to be able to practice it. So this idea that this is all this big grand concept, it's like, well, what interests are served by a country that doesn't have any identity other than you can do whatever you want when you come here? Well, it's just the big plutocratic business interests that want a cheap labor force. So these narratives are just thin covers for these interests. And I think that's one of the things we have to do is deconstruct that and show that to people. And I do think that a lot of these kids that are going to these events and asking these questions are seeing through that. I think they've already seen through it. And I think some of their grievances are really good. So, for example, a lot of these kids, I don't even know. Now, I'm in my 40s, right? I'm early 40s. So I grew up in the 80s and 90s, and we were definitely getting a lot of liberalism around sexual liberalism and social liberalism and things like that pushed on us. But it's gone way above and beyond now in the schools, what I experienced when I was a kid, where you have transsexualism, you have sex ed that's completely decoupled from the idea of reproduction. Like when I was taught sex ed in school, it was still about how are babies made. Now it's like how different positions you can try, different ways to have orgasms with these kinds of things.
God.
It's very not good. And, you know, it's one thing, okay, I don't want to get too much into this, but you know what I mean? Like they're teaching kids how it's a really overly sexualizing these people. Mm-hmm. And you get these guys that have grown up with that. They just, a few years ago, they were in high school. They were being taught about how to do anal sex, how to use sex toys, how to lube and all this. Look, I know it's gross, but you know what I'm saying. And so then they see Charlie Kirk up there promoting homosexuality. And they're like, this is not what we wanted out of a political movement. What are you doing? And that's very powerful. And you know, that is where I think the brilliance comes in. I think the demographic questions, I think it's a good technical question, but in a political environment where it's a clash of personalities, it's a clash of narratives, it's a clash of sort of wills, if you will, in a way, like sometimes the technical details don't matter as much. So it's good for people to understand the demographic situation that America is facing and also Europe. But when you tell Kirk, he'll just say, well, the GOP, we don't believe that race will ever affect your vote. We refuse. So that's a Democrat racist narrative. And then he's done with the question. So there was one kid that asked a question very early in the phenomenon. I really liked it. And he said, you talk a lot about how great immigration is, but I come from a town that was ruined by immigration. My father lost his job. My community was devastated, and my street that I grew up on, it's not the same street anymore. What do you have to say about that? And Kirk just like fumbled around and punted and then took the next question. That was very good. And I really wish that all the questions would be like that. And when those guys were up there talking about Christianity, like I'm not as motivated by religion. I understand some people are, and that's good for them. When they're talking about that, they took that kind of point of view. Of this forcefully moralistic point of view with Charlie, where they're like, "Look, we don't believe that homosexuality is okay. Why are you pushing this on us?" And that's a much stronger position to come out in than just looking at graphs and charts and things like that. And so, I think what I would like to see is a very strong moral fortitude at the center of this to have the confidence to assert ourselves as the interest group and challenge these politicians to meet that goal, to meet our standards, to come to us. You got to appeal to me. You're the politician. I'm not. I'm not politicking to you. I'm not selling. You got to appeal to me, buddy. And that's the attitude people should have. I kind of want to hear what Noah Gill has to say.
Well, I will be brief so we can get on to the next thing that Mark has on the docket. I'll just say this. I worked in the Bush Jr. I worked on the Hill during Bush Jr.'s first term. I was in the Nerve Center for the Conservative Movement. We had representatives from all the branches of government, including the White House, that would come every Wednesday to off-the-record meetings. I saw firsthand. It was also populated, these meetings, these lunches were populated by the heads of the largest conservative organizations in the country. So this is where the marching orders were being given, ladies and gentlemen. This was the Nerve Center. So we had the more than a couple instances. There's one in particular that really stood out to me, and I write about it in my book, Born Guilty, specifically in the book that's inside of Born Guilty called Crucible, or rather a story I was telling in between the books that I share inside Crucible and Prometheus Rising. And it was this. We had a strategist, since this was all off of the record, he was the main strategist for the Republican Party at the time. Since he's still alive, I keep my word, so I won't give his name out, but people can figure out he's fat. He's got wired-rimmed glasses. And he was telling us, lecturing this room full of people, absolutely surfeited and full of people, lecturing the group on what they were going to be doing for blacks, Republicans, what they were going to be doing for Hispanics. This is back then, what they were going to be doing for Asians, what they were going to be doing for Arabs. And this room was 99.5% white. Nobody's saying a thing until one woman, if you want to know who she was, head of a conservative group, had balls. None of the men there had balls. Mm-hmm. One woman had enough balls to say, what about white people? And the place, you could have heard a pin drop in the room. And this fat bastard, anti-white bastard, said to her, we're not going to do anything. Just candidly, we're not going to do anything for white people. They have nowhere else to go but to vote for us. Not a thing we're going to do for them. So this is the reality of the Republican Party, and it has been this way for a very, very long time. Yep. I want to point some other historical things out as well, and that is that conservative people, white people in the United States, have been much more militantly conservative in the past than they are today. And there have been times in the past when they got up at these same sorts of events that Kirk is having and shouted, what do you mean you're going to do X, Y, or Z? And the police escorted them out. You can find these videos still. Yeah. People have converted them from like VHS onto the internet. Yeah. And I read about them way back in the day when I was young, and they were escorted out. What is the big difference? So this is not new. And by the way, this is regrettably, this is not something that was like organized. And, you know, if anybody inspired the first two people that asked the questions that day, it would have been Dr. Duke. And then what ended up happening is Fuentes had a platform that he reported on it, and then he gave suggestions, and that's how he became sort of the cynosure of this Groiper phenomenon, because people who were asking questions got an opportunity to have their name out there, got an opportunity to be celebrated by, you know, 8,000 to 12,000 live viewers a night as Fuentes talked about them. And also sort of this like fantasy-esque, using Star Wars terminology for young guys. But the thing is, I agree with Mike 100%, and that is that all of these questions should be focused on revealing the anti-whites on the right, because that is the thing that these people, now mind you, the white population has been implicitly white. We've known we're white. That's why we white flight to white areas. That's why we mm-hmm. white flight to white churches, white flight all the time to white doctors, etc. We are becoming more explicitly white and white positive. So if you expose these anti-whites on the right with proper questioning that can be explicit and implicit, so that people, some of the most powerful ones will be the ones where the audience draws their own conclusion that comes to the only conclusion available by way of your question. And that is that the policies, the agenda, et cetera, of the conservatives, the Republicans, are going to harm you specifically because you are white. Right. It's not just your ideas that they might disagree with. It's not something that they can be persuaded on. It's the fact that you belong right. to a people that is the problem, and that is how you are going to be harmed. So you're not going to be able to escape this by merely saying, well, I'll just adopt a new idea here, which is mm-hmm. we're going to embrace transgenderism. That's not going to be good enough. It's the fact that you're white. That is the reason why you're going to continue to be harmed by way of the anti-whites on the right, call themselves cuck service. And remember to these folks who are out there right now thinking that they are going to somehow step in front of the line as representatives of Donald Trump. He has already put you out of the stadium. He has already king made Charlie Kirk and that ilk with that big alternative press conference they had. He already put all of us outside. So you're not going to be able to step in front and say, no, we are the real champions of Donald Trump and conservatism, because he will, I think as Mark said, he will disown you at the last minute. He'll tell you what a fool you are. So what I feared, though, is what I'm hearing is happening, and I haven't seen this firsthand, and that is that this happens with women, too, but it happens most with guys, and as soon as I say this, I'll turn it over to Mark to let him move things along, and that is this, that even as young boys, when we had our bicycles and we set up a jump, and a young boy would do the jump, the next young boy would not say, oh, I'm going to do a jump half that size. He would say, I'm going to do a jump twice that size. And so what do you end up having when you have the wrong objective in these questioning of these conservative anti-white bastards? You end up with people saying, well, I'm going to ask the most outrageous question to get the biggest laugh next. I'm going to get a bigger laugh and more shock than the person ahead, the guy or woman ahead of me, so that I'll be the one that is talked about on Fuentes' channel and whoever else are covering the things that's happening with the Groypers by name, rather than asking the most pertinent question that reveals what's happening on the right, that they are actually anti-white. And the other thing about trying to take this simple activity of asking these questions and trying to staple all of these other things onto it to make it into a movement of some sort, that is flawed from its inception, especially once you head down this path. And I also predicted this as soon as I saw this news. As soon as you head down this path of, as they seem to be doing, that this is specifically a Catholic XYZ sort of a thing, then you immediately have the debates of what is Catholicism? Look at what Catholicism did at this point in history and then that point in history. And then you're cleaving off those who are Protestants, and you're cleaving off those who are atheists, and you're cleaving off those who are agnostics. You completely splinter and sectarian everything that we're putting together for the biospirit of our people. And so we end up in these conversations I've heard, I haven't seen it, but from reliable people about what did Catholics do in this period? They oppressed people in this period. And then, they really didn't impress. Who cares what they did? We are going down the toilet. We need to stop with this idiocy about it's not just, it needs to be Catholic and Protestant and atheist and agnostic and all of these different religions from Europe's past. We need to all be able to come together on what matters now and show our white population, which are sensible people, millions in the number, that these people on the right are really anti-white as those on the left. So if you want to put your loyalty somewhere that is going to give you results that will net something positive for you, your children and grandchildren, that's with folks like us. And I'll pass it back.
Well, we've certainly not talked anything about the UK general election yet.
Yeah, seems like that question got lost somehow.
It did. And there is quite a few people who I was hoping for some take from you, Mike. Do you have anything to say about it?
Oh, I actually don't, but I have one more take on this other topic. I can skip it if you want, but I'll just go ahead and spit it out because it's going to drive me crazy if I don't. So, specifically to what you were talking about being harmed as white, there was a question offered to Zioclops, Dan Crenshaw, the one-eyed Zionist. You know, the guy just only sees one side of the issue. He doesn't see very deeply. It's, you know, a whole group of things like that. But anyway, somebody asked him about affirmative action. And he says it's against affirmative action. But not because it excludes white people from education and employment, because it hurts black people. He had some convoluted narrative about how it hurts black people. Mm. And now the person that asked that, these are the kinds of questions I would like people. I like when people ask. So there's some, I always have mixed reactions. Some of them are very good. Some of them I'm a little bit less enthusiastic about, but I also think I've also thought about this. Hey guys, work together. So if Dan Crenshaw or Charlie Kirk blows you off with some bullshit, the next guy in line is like, oh, you know, actually, that's bullshit. Rather than I've got my own new question, like let's keep following this line of questioning. Because if I had Charlie Kirk and Dan Crenshaw for an hour, I would dismantle them head to toe.
Mm-hmm.
But they never give you that opportunity because they know you will do it. Or they know someone like me or No White Guilt or Mark or Patrick, we would do that.
Yep.
But when you're just a guy, you got one, you're like, I got one shot. But get like three guys, get in line together.
Yes.
Plan the questions in a row. And then when it comes with some bullshit, come next. Be like, yeah, and you know what, Dan? You're saying we're talking about white people. We hear all day, every day, what's bad for black people. We hear nothing more than that. Trust me. Have you ever thought that there's bad things that happen to white people? What are you going to do for them, Dan? And the thing is, that's not even bad optics. Like, people talk about optics, so you don't want to look like a Nazi and things. Fine. There's nothing bad optics about saying, hey, I'm white. I'm being discriminated against. What are you going to do for me, Dan? And if someone comes at you for that, then they're the bad guy. They're the asshole.
Yep.
So, yeah. Anyway.
Yeah.
As far as the UK general election, whoever is pissing off the Zionists more, I support. I don't know.
Well, that kind of... I've got one last thing to say, though, before we go to the Super Chats. Just a very small thing I wanted to mention. Mike said this about culture and counterculture. I remember when Paul Joseph Watson sort of came out with this rather cringy statement. He was like, conservatism is the new counterculture. And that was a really interesting point, because what he was trying to say is that the mainstream culture is this sort of degenerate, leftist, you know, based on equality, tolerance, diversity, and conservatism, you know, is the counterculture. It is the counter to that. And never has there been a less true statement than conservatism is the new counterculture. Because every time you see all of these mainstream conservatives, they're actually pushing exactly the same narrative as the mainstream liberals, leftists, pushing all the degeneracy. So when an LGBT pride parade gets green lit through a heavily religious white area which doesn't want it, the conservatives will be cheering just as loudly as all the leftists and the liberals. Conservatism isn't the counterculture. Why Paul Joseph Watson said this, I'm sure you've all got your theories. But the only genuine counterculture, the only culture that is countering this disgusting, degenerate, anti-white, pro-migration narrative that is the mainstream, is nationalism, our brand of nationalism.
Yes.
And this is why Paul Joseph Watson soon abandoned the conservatism is the new counterculture and started calling himself a classical liberal, because he constantly has to rebrand and shift and play with words, because he, whatever people think of him, you know, I'm sure he's no fan of mine. I'm no great fan of his. I'm sure if I met him in real life, I'd have some choice words to say. But the man is fundamentally a coward, because every time he's proven wrong, because he wants to oppose these things, but he can't admit the only opposition to this madness is us. And it's never going to be him. And it's never going to be him because he is a coward, because he wants the money. And it's like you've seen, look, I had nothing but praise for Stephen Molyneux recently and his sort of exposés of a certain question or issue on Twitter. But as soon as he went down this route, he got banned off PayPal, and all of a sudden now it looks like he's trying to walk it back, like he's trying to say something, like he's, oh, I've got to walk back from this, I've got to disavow people. And there's somebody I'm not going to mention tonight, because he is doing good work at the moment, and some people are like, oh, he's the greatest thing since sliced bread. But I see this guy being backed into a corner. I see him disavowing everything. I see him saying things like, I never denied this. I never really said that. It was just a joke. Whereas the rebuttal should be, you're a First Amendment conservative. What's your problem with people having free speech? If you start backing away, once you get on the disavowal train, it's impossible to get off it. And one final thing before we go to these super chats, when you get on that disavowal train, the first disavowal is easy, because you don't understand it. And the first disavowal is always Dr. David Duke. Everyone has to disavow him straight away. That's the first guy, and you feel easy about that. The next person's probably Mike here, because, you know, disavowing a guy on TDS.
It's going to be Richard. The next person's going to be Richard.
Richard and Mike, and then...
No offense to him, right? I'm just saying.
No. You, Richard, Double D, I love you all. But the point is, the next one is then Jared Taylor.
Yeah.
Because whilst we all look at this very close up and we see differences, like if I have a discussion, I see differences between your narrative, Richard Spencer's narrative, DD's narrative, Jared Taylor's narrative. And I see quite big differences at times between the things you guys say and the way you guys approach things. But to the media, when you back away, you're all exactly the same. Mm-hmm. And once you're disavowal train, you might think it's easy to disavow DD or Richard Spencer or Mike Enoch or myself, but very soon it's Jared Taylor, and then it's someone else, and then it's someone else, and then, and before you know where you are, you've had to disavow us all, and you're on a platform totally alone, because that's why they get you to disavow. They get you to disavow so you've got no community, so you've got no friends, so you've insulted all the people who support you and care about you and want to be your teammate. And they do that because whilst you think there are these big differences, to them, to the mainstream media, we're all in the same camp. We're all, you know, just as horrible as the next one. You know, you might think DD is the big bad guy, but to the mainstream media, well, Jared Taylor's just as bad because he talks about racism. Yep.
They don't see a difference between us two.
Exactly. Anyway, we've got to move to these super chats. It's been an interesting chat. I'm really sorry for the people complaining we haven't talked about general election. But is Laura Towler in the chat? Laura, if you're in the chat, I'm going to upset you now by demanding that we do a general election special together. So you've been deputized for that. So let's get through some of these super chats as quickly as possible. Serena JB gave $5. Hi, Mike. I was very disappointed to see you disappear from Twitter. Will you be coming back? I loved your tweets.
I hope to come back. My existence on Twitter is always precarious. I don't even bother pretending. Like, if they're going to get me, they're going to get me. I had a great account that I had for several months. I had amassed like some of my 12,000 followers. They killed it about a month ago. I had another account for a week. They killed it. I had another account for 3 weeks. They just killed it last week. I'm taking a little bit of a break, a little bit of a sanity check, because sometimes Twitter gets to be too much. Like, it becomes your world. You think everything that's going on Twitter is the most important thing. You talk to your friends that aren't on Twitter, they're like, what are you talking about, dude? And I'm taking a little break. I will be back at some point, though, of course, yes. And I know people want the hot takes, but I am taking a bit of a break. I'll probably be maybe after Thanksgiving, I'll come back, which, you know, for those of you in the UK, is next week.
Okay. Junta Hex Momanari, I think that's how you pronounce it, gave $5, and he said, mass immigration is more of a statement, not a question. Mass immigration isn't only a Western problem. Japan and South Korea had massive overhauls in their immigration laws in recent years, and they're receiving record numbers of immigrants. Antifa is active over there too. So thank you for that. Sam Sheridan gave $5 and said, "Hello from hello, not Henlo, but hello from."
No, it's Henlo. It's a joke.
Henlo from Ireland, Mike. Things are getting pretty crazy here. The recent push for hate speech laws. Sorry to hear your Twitter account got banned. R.I.P. in Ranch.
Henlo border. That's the joke. But the joke on boomers, right? Like, they always is like, I just hate explaining the joke. But yes, that's the gag.
I'm not really. I think you guys have your own little in jokes, which
we do. We do. That's one thing we have. Yeah.
The Thin Red Line gave $10. Do you think the BBC interview with Prince Andrew could be used to subvert Britain as a nation, given that, number one, the comments were left on the video, two, the interviewer was of the tribe? I think Prince Andrew is a complete disgrace. I'm making a video about him this week on Friday. It was nothing really to do with the interviewer. It was actually very soft with him. She didn't follow up many of his points at all or press him where he could have been pressed. To be honest, I thought it was one of the weakest interviews. you know, look, here's Prince Andrew, and he's saying to people, oh, I only went to the Epstein dinner parties because he had this wonderful way of connecting me with all these people I couldn't have met otherwise. What? You're a senior royal. You're the Queen's son. You're Prince Andrew. You're not some guy off a council estate who needs a leg up in society so that people notice him, so to get to meet these people. Prince Andrew could have held a dinner party and invited whoever he wanted. He's none of his nonsense added up. And I'm going to do a breakdown of this next week. This Friday is my video. Does anyone want to add anything about the Prince Andrew Epstein case?
I've got something on that. Yeah. Which is, I'm American. We tend to have we don't really take the royals too seriously over here. So like, they kind of seem like just a kind of a bunch of idiots, frankly, and he didn't disappoint in that. And he seemed to me just like a doddering, like a fool, like a dunce. And I was totally unimpressed with him. I mean, at least Prince Charles can sometimes cut like somewhat of a dignified figure, like not this guy. But the thing that struck me was that I was like, you know, of all the people involved in this Epstein scandal, who is it that actually has the least amount of actual power and influence? Well, it's Prince Andrew. So who gets a TV interview that gets humiliated on TV? And yeah, as you said, maybe some of it was softball, but some of these questions, it's like, okay, I don't sweat. I don't sweat. It's like, do you even need to follow that up? It's just like, guy, what are you talking about? And so at that point, it's like he did himself in, and then that becomes what everyone's talking about. When it's like, who's in the background of that picture with you and Victoria Roberts, Prince Andrew? That's Ghislaine Maxwell. Why don't we get an hour with her on the BBC where the reporter can grill her and tear her apart? That's what I want to see. Like Prince Andrew, to me, he's just like an idiot. He's just like an upper class twat, as they say in Monty Python, right? Like he's just like this. Like I'm just that's how I see him, and he's a pervert and he did terrible things. He should be punished for all these things, but I want an interview with Ghislaine Maxwell. That's who I want to talk to. The Israeli spy, Ghislaine. I don't know how to say it. People say it different ways. You know, everyone knows what I'm talking about. Mm-hmm. Epstein's the woman who was procuring these young girls for him. Mm-hmm. That's who I want to hear from. But she's never going to give an interview. You know, I'm surprised she's not back in Tel Aviv. But yeah, so that's I think it's important to talk about Andrew and expose him. But I mean, he of all the people in this scandal is the least powerful, and that's why he's the one that they can put on TV. And he's so stupid, he's going to do it again. Like they're just, I mean, you know, I don't know what to say.
No, I don't think he'll do it again. I don't think he'll go through a second one.
Maybe he will, maybe he won't. I don't know. But again, even the media focusing on will he do it again or not is like, okay, why aren't we talking about the Mossad, child grooming and blackmail ring that's corrupting our politicians? Why aren't we talking about that? So we're talking about this upper class twat, you know?
I see your point, but. I personally think it's a good thing that he's being torn down in this way, because if you analyze his interview, he admitted an awful lot in that interview, which leads to other people that are basically breadcrumbs. It tells you a lot as well about what people like him and the upper classes think of people like us, because to him, he was saying to people, oh, well, I had to tell Jeffrey it was inappropriate for me to be seen with him. Not I had to tell Jeffrey that he was a paedophile scumbag and I never wanted to speak to him again.
I thought I was going to go to hell instead, right? Like,
I had to tell him to go to hell and use some of his billions to compensate his victims. Yeah. No, I told him it was inappropriate. Then I stayed at his house for 4 days and allegedly had a foot massage by a young Russian girl while I stayed there. You know, and all this stuff. This is the kind of thing which makes people realize it truly is us and them. But I go into this in depth in my next video. But look, like, we've got to get through this.
Can I have a word about it?
I don't know
what power the royals have. And there's a lot of people who are involved in this, and a lot of them don't have power. You know, there are a lot of academics, you know, physicists from Harvard or whatnot. But one superlative you could use with Andrew is seemingly, what would he have to gain from an association with Epstein, because, you know, other people, aspiring politicians, what do they have to gain? Well, they have kosher certification, right? They get kosher certified. They're going to have the ways smoothed for them in terms of raising funds for elections, media, probably all sorts of things. But what would Andrew have to gain? But, you know, the one thing I really welcome is, you know, they want the establishment, the Zionist establishment, would like this just to disappear from the news cycle. And, you know, to the extent that people's morbid curiosity in Prince Andrew and this disaster of an interview helps keep attention on it, because this is huge. Because this is, like Mike said, this is all about the Mossad operation. This is one of the ways that the Mossad and the Zionists control our government. And it's been ongoing for a long, long time. I recently broadcast a little bit of the Shah of Iran talking to Mike Wallace about this in 1976. It's been going on for a long time. And that's the real question. And we want people to get to the real question. But if they're not going to get to the real question, at least keep the thing alive for a while with this type of thing. It's better than having it disappear from the pages altogether.
Yeah. I just distrust the motives of the BBC here. I'm like, why would the BBC does not have a good track record in terms of doing things that the Zionist and anti-white establishments want. So if they're doing something to keep it felt to me like this was a distraction tactic. It doesn't mean, as you said, Mark, that you can't analyze what he said and be like, because you know who's not going to be following those breadcrumbs? The BBC. So that's up to us.
But there's lots of people that are following the breadcrumbs. Yes, and the thing is, you've got to remember, why did they give him the interview? Did they give him the interview to put this to bed? Did they give him the interview to help him? Yeah. He just tanked it. Look, it was a terrible interview. You know, and all this nonsense, such as saying, like, oh, I don't sweat anymore. Well, the next day in the papers, there's hundreds of pictures of him dancing with women in nightclubs, sweating like a pig. You know, this is it's a bad and, it, and it's really damaged him. You know, it's damaged a lot, but it's also got a lot of people talking about the Epstein case, so much so it was brought up in the first hustings between Corbyn and Boris Johnson. But anyway, we've got to move on because we've got to get through these super chats. Kai Stevens gave $5 and said, happy Trans Remembrance Day. Be sure to pay your respects to all transhumanists who died while getting their cybernetic implants, robot rights, human rights. Zero Skits, I give $3. Grand Mufti Enoch, can you please suggest to Sven Laden in a TDS episode to play a cover of Institutionalized Suicidal Tendencies, but sang by Grand Ayatollah Striker? Cheers from Peru, inshallah.
I don't know if I can guarantee that particular work, but if you listen to today's episode of Tedious, Maracu has a fantastic cover song at the right around the middle of the show. If you want some new parody songs, it might be a little much for some people. So just warning you, I'm going to put a little bit of an R-rated label on the song, but it's a funny song.
Excellent. Stephen Ben Bob gave $3. What a fantastic guest. Ein Krieger, I'm not going to pronounce all that, so I'm just going to say thank you. $5, great show and great guest. Keep up the good work. Blunderbuss gave $25. Hope this is okay. What about it's going to be hard for me to say that. What about just spraying around the term Jewish supremacist all the time in the same way they spray us, put them on the back foot? Yes, we could try that, but I'm going to give some practical tips on that in a minute, so we'll move on. Revoltron gave $10. Take care this holiday season, brothers, for all that you do for our cause. Thank you. Thank you very much. Russell Savenka gave $5. I was born in the late 50s, and I can tell you that those white adults in 1965, regular working class white people, were not for non-white immigration. So I'm with Jason, not buying Eugene ignorance. And Blunderbuss gave $10, but PJW has the San Francisco is a crap hole videos, Mark, boom, that'll save the West. Indeed. Now, obviously, we want to say something about the UK general election. And I think we do have somebody sent me Another super chat. It says, please let Mike know that he, this is from Unknown Californian. Please let Mike know that he is the juggernaut. I'm grateful. I'm off today. My daughter and I can see our favorite dissidents. I thank you all for helping secure a better future for her. Thank you very much. That's very good of you to say. Now, the thing I want to ask, because we talked about this a little bit, but let's talk about what our people here in the UK should potentially be saying to people at hustings meetings. You know, if our people were to go to hustings, you know, you do have hustings, especially not in Labour dominated areas. In Labour dominated areas where Labour gets 60-65%, they just refuse to hold hustings. They don't need to debate with anyone. But in a lot of marginal areas, they do hold hustings. They hold hustings with all the main the mainstream candidates, and people can go along, people can ask questions from the floor, and they can film it. Let's go around the group. I'll start, then we'll go Mike, Patrick, and Jason. You know, what would people like to see asked? I mean, my big thing would be to ask the candidates, you know, if you look at demographic projections in the UK, leading demographers say that due to mass immigration, white people will be a minority in the UK by 2060. Do you think this is a good thing? And simple as that, is it a good thing that we are becoming a minority? That's a real telling thing, because if these people say, well, yeah, it's wonderful, having that on camera, having the MP for, you know, Slough South or whatever says, white people becoming a minority is a positive. That would be my gotcha, because you're not going into anything where they can sort of Dan Crenshaw you and spin it round on a dime. You're getting them to say either they want to be a minority, yeah, they don't. What would be your tip, Michael? What would you be your advice?
I mean, I think that's good. When I give advice to people in the UK about what they should say, I have to be a little careful, because I know that the environment there is a little different than here. And I know the personalities, I don't know them as well, and some of the issues. I think there would probably be, my guess is there'd be people very interested in Brexit. And there might be some people trying to sort of BTFO some conservatives on Brexit issues about how they betrayed it or blah, blah, blah. Now, my only advice to everybody when they do this is, and you could think of the particular candidate you're going to talk to or the particular surrogate for whichever party you're going to talk to and the issues you want to talk about, always put yourself and your interests at the center. Don't hide behind something. It's not to say, like, I'm here as a white nationalist and you must appeal to me. That might be not the phrasing you want, but I think in terms of the centering of the question, it shouldn't be like the demographics aren't serving the Tory party, right? The Tory party will lose if the demographics change. It should be like, What is the Tory party doing for us real English people, for the true English people? Why should The true English people, the real English people, and they'll know what you mean when you say that. They might get mad, but they'll know. What should real English people get out of the Tories? What are you doing for us? Or Labour even? I mean, at this point, you know, you guys have done that too. So I think that would be my advice, is keep your own interests centered and don't hide behind something else and don't pretend you're something different and don't try and like sort of present as if like I'm the real Trump conservative. No, I am the real white American. That, you know, you see what I mean? That's the only advice I would give. And on those kind of notes, you will find, because they're going to be between, that's going to put them between a rock in a hard place, so to speak. It's going to put them between what the messaging that will be acceptable to the donor class and to the people funding them and to the plutocrats and the media, etc., and what they know are like kind of hair triggers that the electorate's going to get really mad about. Like a conservative politician is going to not want to say it's good that white people are going to become a minority because he knows the constituency is going to be mad. But he can't say, no, it's bad, because then the money people get mad. So you really put them in a tough position, and you can watch them squirm, and that really exposes everything. So that's and they're politicians. So theoretically, they're there to appeal to you, not vice versa. Just always remember that too. That's my advice.
Well, I guess it's my turn, and I think Mike's advice is good. I regarding the British situation, If we're in the context of what to ask a British candidate for MP, exactly what Mike's saying. In context of the United States, because we've got an election coming up, I've been telling people, and I've tried this myself at a Trump rally, go to a Trump rally. If you can go with more than one people, try to do this in unison, because he always does the same things over and over again about Black unemployment and Hispanic income and Asian, whatever. And what about white people? And I've tried it. I didn't get the timing right. I wasn't close enough to the stage, but it can be done. It can be done. So what about white people is a good thing. And then the other thing is that, it's hard enough talking about white people. It is impossible. It's almost impossible to talk about Jews. There's this taboo, but the taboo has to be broken. And there are different ways of breaking it. You can break it like people do in, on our podcast or in the Daily Stormer Mariah Q. I mean, he's great. I love what he does. He's the funniest person out there. But it also has to be broken in a more serious way, and it's tough. But if you're talking about, for instance, affirmative action and affirmative action at universities, who's at the bottom of the totem pole? It's non-Jewish whites. If you mix and non-Jewish whites together, you get this kind of mixed up in between figure, and Asians say, oh, we're the ones being discriminated against, but the real discriminations against non-Jewish whites. And so to find a way to inject that type of thing, the distinction between the lot of whites, non-Jewish whites, and fellow whites, if you can find a way to bring that into the conversation, that's really important.
I only had to pull one of those stupid plastic pins.
Okay.
Great points made by both. And I will just add, there are a lot of things that you can do. And I think the original thrust that we're talking about here that Mike is talking about is really where you have to keep your thinking. And if you keep your thinking in that location, aim toward that objective, you'll come to the best sorts of questions that you can ask. And there are a lot of types of questions that a person can ask that builds your victory into the question, so that there isn't a way for them to have a good response to your question. So I was just... I was crazily jotting down a number of ideas that were coming to me, but I think perhaps one, and it could be changed to numerous iterations. This is so that those listening can have something tangible to go up to the microphone with. You could perhaps go up and ask to the politician, as you don't concern yourself with the welfare and interests of the white British people. So there you've already sown into that question the reality that they don't care about us, as you don't and you've placed it, the conversation, on the interests and welfare of the real English people. As you don't concern yourself with the welfare and interests of the white English people, at what point will you? When 20% of our daughters are being raped by immigrant gangs, when we are a hated and despised minority in the country created by our ancestors, at what point will you begin to concern yourself with the interest? There's no way they can answer that question that will make them look good. You have defeated them with the question. Anything they say in response to that is going to be interpreted. If they say, well, we are concerning ourselves with everybody, every white person there is going to know that is Bravo Sierra. If they come back with any sort of answer like that, you will have made your point. And then if you can, as we've mentioned here, have somebody behind you who can follow it up with a question to piggyback on that, that would be magnificent. You could build out a host of questions like this and really make the politician reveal them for being an anti-white on the right. And could you imagine, I'll just say this also, when it comes to this Edward guy, could you imagine actually saying in an interview that he made a lot of good connections when he rubbed elbows with those people that hung out with a pedophile lord? I mean, could you imagine and getting away with that? I met a lot of great people when we hung out with that pedophile at his pedophile ring, and people are not, I mean, Jesus, why didn't somebody, has no one said it? Where else could you get away with that? I mean, could you imagine? I met a lot of great people when we were hanging out with the drug lord. When we were hanging out with the child molesters. If there were a lot of contacts I made there that were great people.
Well, that was the big thing. You know, you've got all of his reasons for sort of staying friends with Epstein, for sort of working with Epstein, for continuing to visit him. None of them added up. I mean, I'm talking about this in my video this week. It'll be up on Friday as usual. But another thing he said that was very odd was that, you know, he flew all the way to America to tell Epstein it was inappropriate for him to be seen with him anymore. So you're telling me he flew to America, all the way to America, to go to Epstein's house and to wander around in public with him, to tell him it was inappropriate for him to be seen with him. So he was seen with him, telling him it was inappropriate for him to be seen with him. It's just madness. Would a phone call have sufficed? Couldn't he have just rung him up and said, you know what, I don't want to be seen with you anymore. But again, he never said that he went to see Epstein to tell him what a monster he was. You know, he went just to tell him it was inappropriate for them to be seen together, then spent 4 days at his house in New York where young girls were videoed coming and going. I mean, this is the big thing, and this is why I'm not sure why the BBC showed that, because the BBC really exposed just how seedy that operation was. You know, you've got a senior member of the royal family, you know, it's alleged was sat in this house full of young girls coming and going, you know, with a guy who was a convicted paedophile, you know, as he sat there, and witnesses testified that he was getting a foot massage from a young Russian girl. This is absolutely damaging for him. But it's also damaging for everybody else who's been pictured with Epstein. It's damaging for the entire establishment. And it also brings the royals into question again, because they've had these kind of scandals before. They've had associations with people like Jimmy Savile. You know, this is very damaging for them. But it does create a real us and them, because he showed no contrition or no sadness or no empathy about any of it. He didn't empathize with the victims. You know, he was just sat there gushing about, you know, these are extraordinary skills that Jeffrey Epstein had in bringing together extraordinary people. You know,
extraordinary.
Disavow. You know, we talk about refusing to disavow people for having ideas, but you know, this guy refuses to disavow a convicted paedophile and sex trafficker, and he's a senior royal. You know, and look at all the people he's connected to. And I think this is so important on many levels. But anyway, I'm going to be doing a full video on this on Friday. But has anyone got anything else to say about this or about the hustings point?
I do. That's an interesting point. I never thought of it like that. Like, this guy, what world does he live in where he thinks that that's an okay thing to say? Like, how disconnected is this guy? You know, it's like, you know, sure, he's a pedophile, but, you know, there's a lot of good connections you could get to him. What? Now, my next question would have been, if he's like, I met all these good people, I'd be, who? Who did you meet?
Yeah.
Like, we got to know who these people were. It's of interest to the public. Please.
Yeah.
List us who these people were. He wouldn't. Then he'd be like, I can't tell you. Well, why not?
Yeah.
Are they good people? If they're good people, why can't you tell us?
We do have some entropy questions that we've got to do. We've got to get through these questions as well, Patrick. Let's have this quick fire round on these questions.
That's, you know, part of the Epstein thing is, why are all of these academics, whether it's Dershowitz, whether it's these Jewish physicists from Harvard, why are they there? They're there so that Prince Andrew, the people like him, can say, oh, well, I'm meeting lots of people. It's, you know, they're there to. They're
probably also there for the entertainment.
And that too, for some of them. Yeah.
Well, let's get some of these questions out of the way. Let's have a quick fire round. JT asked, Mike, do you see any real third positionist white political movement, as in political parties and party activism, happening in the US anytime soon?
Oh, that's a tough one. As you know, there have been organizations that have tried to do this, varying degrees of success. And the way the U.S. election system works, we don't have the kind of thing that, you know, a lot of European countries have, where they have proportional representation. It's winner take all. And that leads inevitably to a two-party system, because you can always make the threat. you don't vote GOP, these insane Democrats will get in charge. And then if you're a leftist, if you're actually interested in things like workers' rights and stuff like that, well, they can make the same threat on the other side. So, and of course, no one really gets what they want, right? Really, just that's a perfect setup for plutocratic rule. Mm-hmm. And so it's a tough thing to break. But I think we have to, I mean, I don't know, do I see it? It has to happen, whether I see it or not. You know, like we've got to figure out a way to do it. And you know, as No White Guilt was talking about, when the Republicans are saying, we've got the white people anyway, so we don't have to do anything for them. I'm like, all right, well, that's something we can take from them. Yep. Take the people. We don't have the money, that we can't compete with the big corporations. We can't compete with the Zionists, with the wealthy Jews, with the big business that wants them. We can't compete with that. We don't have those kind of resources, but we do have ourselves, our bodies, our votes, our people. So we have to take our support, because they can't exist without it. So we have to form some kind of political alternative. It's going to be very difficult, because organizations dedicated to white interests in the United States are immediately investigated by the FBI, by the SPLC, by the ADL. All these organizations start going after you, trying to find, oh, you misplaced a line item on your tax return or whatever. And you know, like, they will just go do whatever. So it's difficult, but we're going to have to get it together and do it. So whether I see it or not, it's just a necessity.
Okay, well, the next question is for me, and it's from Anglo to the Core. Could you get Richard Lynn on the show? He is probably the best researcher into race IQ, but he's unfortunately getting old. I'm not aware of this guy, but if Richard Lynn wants to get in touch with me and come on the show, that would be a possibility. But one thing I'm saying is, I get asked all the time, can people come on the show? And in the past, I just had people on the show that people have agitated to have on the show. And that's not happening anymore, because it usually ends in some sort of horrific car crash where I'm spending an hour arguing with the guest about something absolutely pointless. And it turns out that they're diametrically opposed to me in some fundamental way. And the show ends up just becoming something where I feel like I'd have had more fun if I'd have spent the last hour pulling my own teeth out with a pair of pliers. So, you know, if people want to put me in touch with Richard Lynn, you know, yes, good. But I want to see something of his content first. So if people want to send me people's content, and we know what I'm talking about, and that particular style of show is not happening again.
Yeah. Adam's well, Richard Lynn was a speaker at American Renaissance in the past, so he's probably on the page with us. But I think he might actually be getting very old, so who knows if he even wants to do something like this.
Well, if he wants to, and if he's going to talk about, you know, if he's on our side of the fence, fantastic. Adam Scott said, what are your thoughts on Count Dankula leaving UKIP and basically admitting he tried to hijack the party for his indecent, degenerate version of free speech? Ooh, that's a hot one. Look, I think the fact that Sargon and Dankula and Paul Joseph Watson all joined the party did very little with it other than drag it into sort of disrepute, then abandon it was a very bad faith move. For example, if you want to just push your particular point of view, do it, but do it in your own party with your own money and let it be on your head. Don't get involved in an existing party, hijack it for one election, and then when you've basically driven it on the rocks of destruction, all abandon it and just leave it there, you know, destroyed. I think Dankula, personally, is one of the honourable ones, because when I asked him about people like, you know, Alison Shablo, about Ursula Haverbeck, about people who were being persecuted for discussing a certain alleged historical occurrence, he actually said, yes, I do stand for their free speech too. So at least he's got the honesty and decency to do that. I have never seen Sargon or Paul Joseph Watson call for free speech for anyone other than themselves. So they're free speech activists when they want to gob off about something, which is usually benign nonsense. But when somebody who actually stands for something a little bit genuinely contentious, they're conspicuous in their absence in campaigning for their freedom. So when Tommy Robinson's being taken to jail, Sargon's bouncing down the street, banging his drum with his free speech banner, you know, wafting in the wind. But when Ursula Haverbeck's dragged off to Gulag for saying, well, maybe these numbers don't add up, you know, Sargon's hidden under his duvet, quivering like some scared child, because he knows he can't say anything about that because it might affect his monetization, which basically means that he's a spineless, worthless person. Because at the end of the day, if you stand for just free speech for you but for no one else, or just when it's expedient for you so you can cozy up to Tommy Robinson, that's not good. Does anyone have any other takes on the Sargon Dankula?
Well, I haven't thought about that whole sordid affair in a while, but I do think that I didn't know that they had left the party and whatnot. And I wouldn't even say that they're out there just for their particular cause. I think they're out there for their particular fame. Like that's what I mean. It's like Sargon was using the party as a vehicle to just like troll people, and some of the trolls became like really bad, like where he said like, oh, I didn't rape her, but you know, maybe I'll give it a shot next time or something. I mean, I think he said something along, I don't want to be incorrect, but I think he made a joke like that. I might be quite wrong. And I'm like, guy, you might not, you know, there's a lot of people's work you're toying with here. Like, you should maybe relax a little bit. And it did kind of tank that party, and it was a shame. And of course, he's, you know, then when he's done, he comes in and does a video. He's like, well, that's what we expected. I'm like, okay, so you expected to get like completely destroyed in front of the entire country. Okay, good. but like, it's just like, what are you about? And then, you know, I don't know, with these guys, it's just, I'm constantly banging my head against the wall. Like, what, you know, the guy that I know you're friends with them too, the guy that is absolutely the best at analyzing these guys and exposing them is Morgoth. He's got the hottest takes on these guys. So, yeah. Mm-hmm. He's a great guy. Yep. Shout out to Morgoth.
He is a great guy. He has some very, very good takes. So does a guy called Keith Woods as well from Ireland. He's a real up-and-comer. I intend to get both of them speaking at one of my conferences next year. So, you know, real great guys. And I can't sort of recommend them enough. I think that's one of the great things about what's happening in this movement at the moment. We're growing it and we're bringing in people who can all give good takes. It's not one of those movements that you see, like the Sargon movement, which is basically Sargon, or the Tommy Robinson, which is basically Tommy Robinson, or, you know, the Brexit Party, which is Nigel Farage. This movement has so many other talented people, and it's not just a tentpole movement. It's a movement that has real structure, real shape, real form. You know, and I'm not even mentioning at the moment people like Laura Towler, people from abroad who are working with us, people like Frodi Midjord, you know, like everyone on this panel, you know, everyone here can give good takes. It isn't a one-man movement. It's not a cult of personality. And I think another big problem with Sargon's election campaign was a cult of personality. And as soon as someone said, well, you know, maybe if you're going to fight for freedom of speech, you should be fighting for freedom of speech for maybe the fathers who tried to talk out about the grooming gangs and were arrested, you know, that's something people could get on board with rather than just rape jokes. And at the point people said that, Sargon's cultists, I mean, I have never seen such a group of people who claim to be so woke and so sort of against cults or, you know, sort of religious fervor act in such a cultish manner. The Sargon people were absolutely cultists.
What I told Sargon at that point, if he listened to me or not, and I think Morgoth was saying the same thing, when they bring up your rape joke, you bring up Rotherham. How did this not occur to you?
Yeah.
And you could have said, look, people make distasteful jokes. It's not I mean, I know it was like, don't apologize, right? He learned that lesson in entirely the wrong way. it's like, look, I made a rape joke on the internet. Okay, whatever. People say offensive things on the internet. You want to talk about rape? I got something for you. How about Rotherham? How about all of these scandals? And then you would see that BBC reporter start sweating like Prince Andrew. So, yeah.
Oh, when you bring up, when you talk about these things, you have to always throw it back on them. Like, yeah. For example, when I think it was Victoria Derbyshire, she was interviewing him and he made a complete hash of it. He tried to claim that he'd been a victim of some kind of sexual assault.
Yeah, he had been raped.
Yeah, everyone in his family had been raped. You know, he'd been diddled multiple times. He was diddled on the way into the studio. You know, couldn't she feel his pain too? You know, it was so cringy. But if he'd have just turned it around and says, how can you talk to me about integrity? You work for an organization that has covered up systematic child abuse and the abuse of women on numerous occasions. Right. Yet you're happy to take money from these people. Don't talk to me about integrity.
I'll be out about rape when you go out and you talk about Rotherham and all the other scandals. I don't believe you. Oh, you're clutching your pearls because I made a joke. What about all these girls that were really raped? That's how you answer that question. That's how you wreck the BBC or whoever else he's talking to. But again, I don't know. Again, he's not as bright as he thinks he is.
And the big question tonight now in the chat is, did Sargon get diddled? That's
I don't want to know.
That's the big question. That's the big question. So, and somebody's put Sargon was sweating like Prince Andrew.
That's going to be a new thing. Yeah, you're sweating like Prince Andrew over here. Something's going on.
Oh my god.
What incredibly sweaty.
But I just think whenever you're talking about things, it's all about how you relate it to the public. Like, I was talking to somebody about immigration the other day, and they were saying, well, you know, how does it affect me? I said, well, do you like that 45-minute commute you have to sit in? Well, no, but why is that anything to do with immigration? Well, more people, mate. It's more people on the roads. You know, do you like the waiting lists in the hospitals? You know, because the more people in the country, the longer the waiting lists are going to be. Do you like every bit of Greenbelt being cut up and housed over? Well, no, I don't. I hate all these new developments. Well, why do you think they're building new houses? And once you relate what you're talking about to normal people, they understand. But you have to put your points in a relatable manner. And I have never once in my life, and I have been into hundreds of working class pubs, I've campaigned on dozens and dozens of working class estates, I've knocked on thousands of doors and probably delivered hundreds of thousands of leaflets in my time. And never once in that entire duration of political activism have I ever heard anyone say, you know what? The big issue is we don't have enough rights to tell rape jokes. Because people can't relate to that. But anyway, we are coming to the end of the show. So, Mike, please tell us where we can find you. And thank you so much for coming on. And it is the first time you've been on PWR, but we hope to have you back again. Sure. And, you know, it's a shame we don't do more regular shows, because if we did, we'd have you on more regularly.
Sure. I mean, we should just keep in touch. We could talk about you coming back on TRS sometime soon.
Please, let's make that happen.
Yeah. So, yeah, I'm on therightstuff.biz. That's where you can find Tedious and Strike and Mike, our sister show, Fash the Nation, FTN with Jazz Hands McFields, and now James Alsop is his co-host. A lot of great shows and a lot of other podcasts. We have The Absolute State of Britain is also hosted on our site for our friends across the pond, which is where I get my stuff about Britain from. So that's the site, therightstuff.biz. We do have a subscription service. We appreciate people signing up. You do get extra content, a couple extra shows a week. And also check out my friend Eric Stryker's new news website, national-justice.com, where he's got a lot of articles relating to our interests from, shall we say, a more journalistic perspective, less of a trolley perspective and a more journalistic perspective, something I think I've been lacking for a while. So it's a great site. I've got an article up there today about a legal case against the SPLC in the United States. So go and check it out.
Excellent. And as we're live now on Radio Albion 2, we can't overrun by any more than 5 minutes. So please, Patrick, please tell us where we can find you and how we can contribute to your excellent work.
So I have a daily show on the Republic Broadcasting Network that airs at 2 p.m. Eastern, 1 p.m. Central, which means it goes head-to-head with this show. But you can catch the Wednesday show on the archives. You can get to the archives through nationalbugle.com. And, of course, my Wednesday show that I do with Jeremy from Kentucky. And then I do the Monday shows with Mark Collett. And I have Boomer Vision some days, a great Boomer Vision and all sorts of stuff and some parody songs by Engelbert Poindexter, all sorts of good stuff. Then on morning Rents Radio Network, we have the Stormfront show, formerly known as the Morning Aloha Report, and that is at 10 p.m. Eastern. And from time to time, you'll find me with David Duke and also shilling nonstop for the Co-Certified app, which is totally my sponsor. So download the Co-Certified app. You can find that at nationalbugle.com as well.
And Jason, where can we find you? And is there an after party this week? Please advertise it now quickly.
there's an after party Thursday evening with John Gage, Angelo John Gage. We also have, I'm going to go live in 15 minutes for a brief going free. And then tonight at 9 p.m., we'll have an after hours where we will have Oliver Semiagog. And I just want to say a big thank you to Mike for coming on. I think you're infinitely better than Syrian Girl. I mean, maybe some giant lip injections would make a difference with some of the audience. But and maybe also if somebody could make a meme of Prince Andrew with that country song "Friends in Low Places," that would be hilarious. So thank you all for showing up today, and we'll see you next time. Pass it back to you, Mark.
Thank you. I just got to say, I love both Mike and Syrian Girl, but I think Syrian Girl's far better when we're talking about odd things that you don't expect her to talk about. When she got off the beaten track, she was extremely funny. I'd like to thank everyone who came on tonight. It's been an absolutely fantastic show. We'll be back next week. Hopefully we will secure the Irish guests for next week and talk a little bit about the growing nationalist presence in Ireland. That will be very good. And I will be back on Friday with my show, my regular video show, which will be about the Prince Andrew debacle. And that about wraps it up. So if you enjoyed the show, you can donate or you can contribute via Bitcoin. My Bitcoin is in the description. And I would just like to thank everyone, the panelists, our wonderful guest, Mike Enoch, all those who generously donated over on Entropy, and of course, the audience. I love you all, and I will see you at the same time next week. Thank you.